Valeska Haas is the latest guest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Valeska is a project manager in the Business Improvement and Projects Unit at the University of Kent. She talks about working in the automotive industry, delivering intercultural training for sales teams. We talk about the importance of transferable skills. We talk about being born in Germany, growing up in Namibia, and later Venezuela. Valeska talks about living in the UK for the past 13 or 14 years. It's the longest time that she's ever been based in one country. We talk about the concept of home. We talk about her earliest memories, which she associates with eating cottage cheese. We talk about the notion of homesickness. We talk about a frozen memory of the places she has lived, which always stays with her and which hasn't been spoiled by subsequent visits. We talk about her experience of finding African drums in Venezuela, her passion for music, and how she has adopted new tastes in the different locations where she has lived. We talk about Valeska's time in university in Germany and some of the differences in the different university styles and structures. We talk about the student protests that took place at the time that she was at university. We talk about people's fear of the other in the context of the apprehension of strangers to her family's different and exotic life story. And then in the final part of the interview, Valeska shares why her memories are mainly positive, why she has been doing creative writing in her spare time, and we find out what her ambition is. She talks about living in the here and now rather than looking back to the past or forward to the future, and we talk about some of the possibilities inherent in the notion of nostalgia. My name is Chris Deasy, so join me for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Valeska Haas. Okay, well, my guest this afternoon is Valeska Haas. So welcome, Valeska.
Thank you.
And I've often said at the beginning of my interviews that I don't necessarily know all of my interviewees very well. I think in your case, we've met a couple of times, but do you want to just give me a little sort of indication about what you do at the university and how long you've worked here?
Yeah, so I am a project manager. I work in the Business Improvement and Projects Unit, have been for the past 2 years. And before that, I worked as a project officer in the Faculty of Social Sciences, again for about 18 months, I think. So I've been here since 2014.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. For a minute I thought you could say 2004, and I thought, that's how long I've been here, but I realised that, no, I really have been here a very long time. So that's absolutely fantastic. Mm. And what about your career before you moved to University of Kent?
So I started off in the automotive industry, really. I worked there for a few years, sort of customer service, key account management roles, but also delivering intercultural training for sales teams. And then I moved on to Aston University in Birmingham. I worked there in the School of Languages. I prepared students for their year abroad. Again, that was this intercultural training thing that came into that. Then there was a big restructure. So basically they moved all the placements and employability offices into one central office. And in the course of that, I applied for a project manager role to lead some of those change elements, really. And that's what sort of brought me into project management and change management. And that's where I got stuck.
In terms of the car industry, motion, clearly. Yes. The wheels were set in motion. But it's interesting that we often talk about transferable skills with students. And, you know, sometimes you might, you know, a student might say, I teach in religious studies, and it might be, okay, well, how is this degree going to be transferable to the workplace. Mm. And of course, in many ways, just by standing up in front of a class of students and giving a paper and undertaking research skills, whatever the content might be, they are skills that can be hugely important in, you know, a whole variety of different professions. And so in your case, it's fascinating that although you were working in an area that, you know, when you first said the car industry, I thought, well, you know, that's so a million miles away. But maybe it isn't actually from what you're doing. Do you sort of feel that in some ways what you're doing now is quite similar in some ways, or do you think it's a completely different sort of way of looking at the world?
I do think that it is very different from where I started my career. But yes, I mean, you're absolutely right. You learn as you go along, and those skills will always be there, and you can go back to them at a later point in your career.
Yeah.
I mean, I studied in Germany, and I studied a course called International Information Management, which was basically a combination of intercultural communication, linguistics, information management, business, politics. So there was a little bit of everything. And I think some of the skills and the knowledge that I have picked up through that study has, you know, still helps me now. But you learn as you go along, I guess.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, and in many ways, I mean, we often talk about things like lifelong learning and lifelong education, but actually that's exactly it, isn't it? You know, the idea that somebody, you know, has a particular qualification and then they're made, they're sorted, you know, it's not you know, very far from the case in many ways. Whatever qualification you have, academic or otherwise, it's often, you know, the springboard. It's an important sort of way onto, you know, as a step up the ladder, but it gives you the license to step up the ladder. But actually, you know, the rest of your career is often the sort of the way. So hopefully you go upwards, but, you know, sometimes we get stuck on the wrong, or sometimes we go backwards, but, you know, it's live and learn. But you mentioned Germany, so is that where you're from?
It's where I was born, yes. So I was born in Germany, but I grew up mainly in Namibia and in Venezuela. So my dad was a teacher, and he taught at German schools abroad. When I was 4, we moved to Namibia. So my childhood years I spent in southern Africa. And then we went back to Germany for a little while, and then moved to Venezuela. And then for university, I moved back to Germany.
So you've lived in Europe, Africa, and South America?
Yes.
Goodness. Okay. Well, when I moved to Kent in 2004, I remember meeting a colleague in another school, and he said that he travelled quite a way to come here. And I said, oh, me too. I used to live in Carmarthen in West Wales, and now I'm all the way over here, thinking I went right the way from the west coast to the east coast. And he was giving me this really funny look, and I thought, well, you know, what's so unusual about the story I've just told? And I said, well, where have you come from? And he said, South Australia. And I thought, you know what? Okay, you win hands down. But no, what a fascinating. So do you kind of feel, in terms of the definition of home, that for you, because at different periods in your life you were growing up in such culturally diverse environments, that you know, that sense of what is home to you is quite a sort of a varied one? Or do you sort of pick one of those three and say, yes, that, for, you know, in terms of your identity, that's where you belong?
Home for me has always been the people that I have met. I mean, when I left, for example, Venezuela, my parents were still there, so I moved back to Germany. But when I said I was going home, then that for me meant I'm going back to Caracas. And in a way, I think my home, as from a childhood perspective, is very much Namibia. So there's definitely got a very big space in my heart that is reserved for that country, because obviously 4 to 9 is a very formative years, and I have a lot of memories of that time. So I think in a way that's probably sort of where my heart or a big part of my heart is. But I've lived in the UK for 13 years now. It's actually the country that I have lived in longest, even longer than in Germany. So, you know, it's all a little bit home. I guess.
Yeah, and I was saying in some of my previous interviews as well that in my case, I feel more Welsh when I'm in a place like Canterbury than I do when I'm in my country of origin, shall we say. And I think it's because there's a part of me that feels that, you know, I've got something distinctive to bring, which comes out more when you're in a slightly more, inverted commas, alien environment. Whereas when I'm back in Wales, you know, what stands out is that I don't sound like everybody else. So my Welshness seems almost like partial, it seems almost like qualified. So I kind of feel sometimes that being away from home, you know, sometimes can reinforce that sense of belonging, paradoxically. But in terms of things like earliest memories, then, do you how far can you go back? What's one of the sort of earliest things you ever remember doing?
I think my very earliest memory is the day that my sister was born, who's 3.5 years younger than I am. And it's I only really remember sitting at the kitchen table with my grandmother eating cottage cheese and my dad coming into the kitchen saying, it's a girl again, and being really happy about it. And that's sort of, I think, my earliest memory. And that was about a year before we went to Namibia. And everything that comes after really starts in Namibia. So I don't have many memories of my time in Germany before that. But I can still remember when we arrived there and what it sort of felt like. And obviously, you know, the people look different and the landscape was very different. And we stayed in a very big house of a colleague of my dad's at the beginning. And I still can remember that house, because everything was just, very sort of spacious. And then we moved to a small farm just outside Windhoek. And, yeah, I have various memories of those really early days in Namibia.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that when you meet colleagues here, because certainly in Seckle, where I work, obviously there are quite a few colleagues who have, for example, a Hispanic origin, and certainly worked or studied in South America. So do you sometimes find, in terms of what you were saying earlier about it being the people rather than the place that gives you the sense of belonging, that in the same way that when I meet a Welsh student, I think, oh yeah, you know, we have this wonderful commonality. Do you get sort of really quite sort of excited because you've got this incredibly, you know, we all have a unique story, but in your case, one that is, you know, quite distinctive because of the different continents, not just countries, that you've lived in. And do you sort of feel that sometimes that when you meet other colleagues, for example, in Canterbury from anywhere near where you may have stayed, does that sort of reinforce that sense of belonging, or does it bring about any sort of homesickness?
Yes, absolutely. I have a couple of friends here in Canterbury who are from South Africa, and actually I have met them because they sat behind me at a concert, and I heard the South African accent, and so just turned around and started talking to them, and it turned out they'd just moved to Canterbury. That was like 2 years ago or so, and we've become really good friends. But the reason that I actually talked to them in the first place was because I heard the accent and thought, oh, home. And yes, likewise with people who have links to South America, or Germany sometimes as well, you know. It's, yeah, you do sort of listen to that, and homesickness is really an interesting one, because I'm always homesick no matter where I am. So I am here and I miss the African sun or the Venezuelan beaches or the German bread. So there's always elements of something that that I miss no matter where I am. And likewise, I guess if ever I move away from England, I think there will be things that I miss about here as well. So yeah, you
I'm trying to work this out myself, because there are occasions in my life when I've thought that was a really good day, and you sometimes think, will I be thinking about this day in 20 years' time, you know? But sometimes, especially as somebody who keeps a diary, I sometimes think that, you know, those events that I do remember don't always have a record from the time in my diary, for example, that makes me think, oh my God, wow, you know, it's more that it's the passage of time that sometimes, you know, makes you, and maybe in the light of subsequent events in terms of people you meet or things that you do, that something that may have seemed incidental in the past suddenly takes on this huge, you know, cosmic significance. but what about in your case? Do you, when you were sort of, you know, seeing the African sunset, were you thinking, now this is something that, you know, I'm going to take with me for the rest of my life? Or is it after leaving Africa you thought, I missed the sunset? Canterbury doesn't quite have the same appeal.
I think the... Well, with Africa in particular, obviously the memories that I have of Namibia are the memories of a child, and sometimes I have to remind myself of that. There are things like, you know, safaris and African sunsets and the stars and the night skies in Africa that are just memorize, and I think if you've seen them once, you will never forget that. But a lot of the life there is the memory of a child. And even if I was to go back there now, I might like it or I might not like it, but it won't be the same. It will be very different. I did go back a couple of times, once in my teenage years, and about 15 years ago I went back again, and things there change as well, but in my memory it stays this sort of frozen that the memory is frozen in a way. It's a frozen image of Namibia.
So that original memory stays with you. It hasn't been supplanted or replaced or spoiled by those subsequent visits.
No.
Yeah, I find that with music sometimes. We'll come on to that in a minute. Mm. But I sometimes find that I can often remember the first time I heard something rather than maybe the 20th time or the 100th time. Otherwise, you know, you're adding on lots of layers to something. Mm. But there's something about almost the original sort of, you know, this is the core of you know, where I was at a particular time, at a particular age when I first heard something.
Mm.
And I think that's good, because otherwise everything just becomes a little bit sort of random otherwise. Tell me a bit about the different cultural things that you witnessed while you were growing up. Because, I mean, musically, for example, in the different countries you were in, I'm assuming that there was some completely different and discrete sort of sounds and opportunities, really, in terms of listening to music, having music played live and performed live, as well as maybe what you picked up through the radio, for example. But is there anything that particularly stands out? Film might be another area to explore, where you think, you know, you saw something and it's like completely unprecedented and nothing in your life since. You've never witnessed those sounds or those films in any other place that you've lived.
Music, definitely. I think it's interesting. Music in Africa involves a lot of drums, and in a way, I found those drums again in Venezuela, because there are, you know, big black communities that have a very similar style of music. So I when I was then in Venezuela listening to that, it reminded me of Namibia. There's various bands, South African music, like Johnny Clegg, for example, that I still like to listen to now. There's loads and loads of Latin American music that I listen to, because obviously that was then my teenage years when I started to develop my own taste in music. There's bands like Maná or Soda Stereo, which is an Argentinian band, but also just the more traditional merengue music and so on, which I listen to a lot nowadays, and it sort of puts me back to those points in time that you were mentioning earlier. I mean, my parents are very much of the Beatles and Stones and Joe Cocker generations. So I did grow up in a household where we did listen to a lot of music anyway, and as we moved around, they adopted new tastes for the music and in the different locations. So yes, that's definitely a big thing.
And do you have an urge to share that music? Because for me, if something has really made an impact on me, and the same goes for films as well, something that there's a part of me that wants to be almost sort of missiological, that almost wants me to sort of shout from the rooftops and say, oh my God, you know, because I had this amazing experience listening to it or watching it, I kind of want other, I want it, there's something infectious almost in, you know, the way that I want to sort of say, oh, you must listen to this, you know, because it changed me in some way. You sort of think that almost like an obligation to say, listen to this, it's amazing. And of course, often other people's musical tastes don't, you know, impact on you in the same way. But so when you're listening to this, do you want to say to your friends or family, do you want to say, hey, you must listen to this, you know, what do you think of this sound? And, you know, then do you sort of get a bit disappointed when they say, well, you know, it's not my thing, because of course sort of, you have a particular history around that. So is sharing music something that's big, important for you?
Yes, although exactly that disappointment, I have experienced that, and I think so I've become probably a bit more selective about who I'm sharing what with. My partner and I, we do it quite often that we just spend a whole evening playing music to each other and then sort of remembering the moments where those pieces of music were important, and I think that's a really nice way of sort of sharing memories. And obviously when you have friends from certain times, you go back to the music that you listened to at the time when you meet them. My friends are all around the world, so some of them I don't see very often, but when we get together, that's definitely one thing that we do, is bring out the old music from the days when we spent school together.
And might that be on vinyl, for example? Do you actually have it in the original format, or is this on CD, or in some cases is it live music that you might be playing?
It's mainly on CD, I think. Yeah. Live music not so much, no.
I thought you were going to say that you've got all the drums. You've got my Venezuelan drums. No. So that's, you know, that would be an evening, you know. Yeah. I'd wangle an invite.
That's actually quite funny, because I'm not very musical. I don't play an instrument. I can't sing to save my life, but I've listened to music all my life, and it's a really important thing for me to do that. Also to dance to some of the music, because dance is very important in, you know, African as well as Latin American culture. It's something that I have grown up with, and I can never understand in some European contexts when you have really good music and people just stand there still, or they might maybe move their foot, but they don't really dance to the music. And
Or you're at a concert, and of course it's seated, and unless it's the encore, it's frowned upon if you stand up, not least because of course you're blocking other people. But music is, you sit down and you appreciate it,
yes,
rather than actually do it. Yeah. Do you know, it's interesting because music is so foundational for me, and yet when I was really young, because I liked listening to music, I thought, oh, I must learn to play the piano. And, you know, I couldn't have been less interested. And it's funny that for me there was this complete mismatch between the listening, which was something very radio-based, and the actual performance of that. And for me, it suggests to me that there's more to music than, you know, wanting to be able to replicate that. It's, for me, it's about the situation. It's the contextualization of sounds, the structure of it, you know, almost like it's an addendum to keeping a diary. And I think I made the mistake once in just assuming that I would therefore want to play my own, but no, it's other people's music that I'm sort of like autobiographicalizing, if that's a word. So, you know, I think it's what you were saying sort of dovetails with my own, you know, experience there. But what about the path that took you to go to university? You know, how where were you living at the time when you were going through the application process? Which were you in Europe at the time, or were you in South America?
In Venezuela, yeah. So I finished my school education in Venezuela, and I found it very, very hard at the time to decide what I wanted to do, which is probably why I chose, in the end, a course that was very varied and quite, sort of more generalistic rather than a specialization on something. And I think I haven't regretted that choice because it has given me a lot of opportunities after university to really decide where I wanted to go.
But it's sometimes a little bit, sometimes I feel really happy for somebody when they say, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. You know, I'm going to do this degree and I'm going to do this and do that. It's all mapped out. But part of me also that thinks, oh, mine isn't. You know, am I missing something? You know, am I not organized enough? But I think it's sometimes you have to go with the flow sometimes. Otherwise, you're going to be so stuck in a particular niche that, you know, you're not living. And the fact that you obviously have such a varied childhood, terms of the geographical locations where you were growing up, I guess actually in a way sometimes, you know, it's unlikely that you're suddenly going to go to do a particular course and everything is going to be mapped out. You know, why not find the right path for you? And nothing is sort of set in stone. Because was that your sense? I mean, do you, after doing your degree, did you find that there were lots of different sort of career options and you were almost sort of like, you know, picking and choosing and, you know, trying a few out and experimenting before finding the right thing for you?
Yes, definitely. I think, trying it out is probably a good phrase. I did quite a few placements whilst I was studying. So I did placements with a political foundation in Venezuela, and I did sort of marketing PR type placements, and then I went to London and worked with Bosch there. And so I just sort of, before I even finished my studies, tried very different careers, which is why I think that's a very good thing to do for students, to try it during their studies, because then you can also, you can kind of tailor your learning a little bit to what you're interested in as well. I mean, university in Germany at the time that I was at university was very different to what it is here and what it is in Germany now as well. It was very much this open Humboldtian concept of education. I could sit in any lecture that I was interested in. I could, I did create my own timetable. There was some very basic rules around this is what you have to do as part of your course, but a lot of choice around that so that you could really tailor it to your interests, and also just go and sit in a lecture that had nothing to do with what you were studying.
When you said that, although this is obviously audio, not video, but if it had been video, you'd have seen my my jaw dropped visibly when you said that, because that sounds amazing, but it's not quite the way things are done here. But so did that include across different disciplines like humanities, sciences?
Yes.
So it was a very eclectic program. We have wild modules, we pride ourselves, it's a brilliant thing that Kent does, but to actually have the freedom to do whatever you wanted. But did it also mean that it was so flexible that you ended up without the sort of the essence of what you were looking at, or things like registration and actually being seen to be following a particular path? It sounds as though you need to be really structured and disciplined to get the most out of it.
Yes, I mean, as I said, there were some core modules that you had to do in order to pass your course, and then some options that you could do to pass your course. But you could do on top of that whatever you wanted. And I think that's something that, when I was still at school, was the attraction of going to university. It was this broadening your horizon and learning about different disciplines. Obviously, there's a limit to what you can fit into a week. So if you create your own timetable and then you have 30 hours in it, then you realize very quickly that that is really not achievable, and then that means that you have to concentrate on the core things that you need to do. But it doesn't stop you from doing the one or two modules per semester to and just look at something.
And was anyone validating this? So when you were creating your own timetable, did you have like a personal tutor who was saying, yeah, that looks good? Or was it completely down to your discretion?
Yes, it was. Which is, you know, why a lot of people took a very long time to finish their course, because obviously what they had to bring in the end was, yes, was the results from those core modules that they had to do. If they were doing only other stuff, then obviously that created a bit of an issue. But
once you'd chosen a course, did you have to stay with it for the whole of that semester that it was running? Or was it the case sometimes that you'd, you know, on a week-by-week basis, you'd say, oh, maybe I'm not so keen on it after all, I'll try something completely different, a language or whatever, you know, the following week?
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, you could have done that, but I don't think that's something that people did. If you were interested in something enough, then you would follow it through for the whole semester, I guess.
Because although I can imagine that some people would find that so open, you know, that, you know, you need sometimes the undergraduate degree, at least, you know, sometimes it's so structured that it's really good because, you know when you have to give the essays and you know which classes you have to go to, you know the rules. You know, often when it gets to postgraduate study here, that's when sometimes, because you have more scope sometimes and less tuition, you know, and it's much more sort of self-directed learning, then sometimes some people don't find that lack of structure good for them. But I have to say, what you're just outlining just sounds like that's what a university in a way should be about. You know, you're learning, you're picking up new interests, you're not just following the sort of the path of you know, almost like going into the comfort zone of that's what I've done before, so I'll just continue doing that because it's safe and secure and I know I can, you know, get by. It sounds like you were really living, and it sounds as though you probably had some really inspirational teachers who perhaps you look back on and think, yeah, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have achieved my goals.
It's funny, inspirational teachers, I think it's more the really the concept that I found inspirational about it rather than individual teachers, because it is a lot more about self-directed learning. Yes, I've had very good lecturers in at university. I've had very bad lecturers at university as well, but it wasn't the person in itself that made the difference. I don't think it was more this. I think this feeling of I can really take my learning into my own hand here. I mean, I spend hours in the library just reading, not for a particular course, but just whatever I liked, and I pulled out the book and read it, and that was part of it, and I had time for that, and I think that's very important.
That's one of the real joys, isn't it, when... At first you might be intimidated by going to a library and you're thinking, look at all these works. In some cases they're by, you know, written by theorists who were alive centuries ago. And you think sometimes, how can I, in the course of the next few weeks or months, when I have an essay to write, possibly digest all of this material? But when you do, and you sort of know what you're looking for, and you can, you know, take the best bits from the different sources, then you suddenly say, hang on a minute, I've made a contribution. And for me, the degree was a wonderful experience because, you know, I think, okay, I've got, I mean, I remember doing an essay on the disestablishment of the church in Wales. And I thought, you know, really, you know, is this something that I'm interested in? It was a bit of a challenge because I thought, okay, let's see where this takes me. And I spent a week of intensive research preparation and, you know, getting all the relevant books, and then a week of writing it. And suddenly I thought, I'm hardly an expert, but at least I thought that, you know, what I've done in these few weeks is to be able to speak knowledgeably and actually with some passion on a subject that I genuinely had no interest in. But it wasn't deterred by the subject area. Thinking, oh, it's a bit dry. Actually, I found that I was, you know, really sort of engaged in this whole question. But of course, this was in the early 90s, and now, you know, with independence and devolution in so many countries around the world, all those debates are there. Somehow, some of those things, which may have seemed dry in the 1990s, somehow I can understand now why people might be looking for a different way of understanding, whether it's in religion or in politics, their sort of relationship to particular hierarchies or particular churches or organisations. Mm. But your experience just sounds absolutely amazing, and you gave the impression as well that some people took very long to complete their degrees, suggesting that there wasn't the same sort of time frame that we have over here, where it's, unless it's there's a year abroad element, it's strictly 3 years.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. I mean, it has changed now, obviously, with Bologna. Things have changed in Germany as well. And there is still a lot of discussion around if that is a good thing or not, and what it has done to university degrees and so on. And I think probably a mixture of the two and some balance would be a good compromise, particularly because higher education in Germany has been largely free for the past decades. There was a little bit of a trial season over a few years where some of the federal countries tried to introduce tuition fees, but it has never really stuck. So they have gone back to pretty much free education. You pay a small administration fee. But obviously, if you then have students who spend, 6-7 years to complete their degrees, then that there needs to be some sort of control mechanism to avoid that. I completely agree. But we seem to have gone to that other extreme, which is a very school-like system that has that one outcome that you need to achieve. And I do wonder whether that takes away from the learning experience. Mm. I certainly think, compared to my university education, I certainly think it does.
Yeah, it's that interplay between process and goals, isn't it, sometimes? Mm. That it's the journey there. The goals don't just happen, and they can't, they're not contrivances. You can't sort of get round them. You do the work and then you have an outcome, but the actual journey of getting to that goal can actually sometimes be quite circuitous, or sometimes it can be take you in all sorts of different places, but that's what you remember. and sometimes it's great to get a certificate at the end of a degree, but also sometimes the experiences along the way are no less important. It's not just about the qualification at the end of it, it's actually what you learnt about yourself and your interaction with others, both on and outside of your course, that I think makes a crucial difference.
Yeah, I also think that this more flexible way of, creating your own timetable, for example, was very helpful, because I did work all through my university education. I worked 15 to 20 hours a week, so that was really a really good way for me to fit my work around education and vice versa. And I could be... My employer was flexible about it, but my university was also flexible, and so it was a lot easier to organise, I think, than when you have a rigid timetable and you have to organise only one thing around the other.
Yeah, it doesn't always work that way, so it sounds like a perfect synchronicity. No, that's great. Mm. What about things that happened when you were at university in terms of, sports or films or music or politics or religion? There must have been, especially in South America, in Venezuela, there must have been some huge, influences, artistic, cultural, dance, that you must have witnessed and maybe even participated in. What sort of period are we talking about? How many, what sort of era was this period when you were at university?
So university was, I started in the late 90s, 97. My first year at university was actually... There were a lot of student protests and strikes at the time from students. I think probably the biggest protests after 68, actually, because basically what happened was that the German universities had sort of space for approximately a million students, but there was 1.8 million students. So what could happen is that you had a lecture theatre with 40 seats, but you had 100 people in it trying to attend that lecture. And so there was a lot of protests going on at the time to really, yeah, students, I don't know, occupying buildings, and that was my first few months of my university life, which was quite a political introduction. And but brought the discussion onto the agenda nationally, and then I think also had a big influence on the elections in Germany the year after, which was when Gerhard Schröder, then the Social Democratic Chancellor, got elected, and the era Helmut Kohl came to an end after, I don't know, 16 years, I think it was. So there was quite a shift there in national politics as well, and the Social Democrats put education very high on the agenda. So yeah, I think I came from Venezuela, where obviously I hadn't been sort of part of the day-to-day German politics, into a very political era at university. And also all my friends at university were very interested in politics and discussing it a lot and so on. So that was quite a change. I mean, obviously, Venezuelan politics are very different, and they have very different problems in those countries, and had at the time. I mean, in the time that we lived there, I experienced a couple of attempts to overthrow the government, and some quite violent as well. I remember one day where we basically spent the whole day in the cellar because they were flying over the house with, the planes of the army were throwing bombs on a police station very close to our house. And so, yeah, that's a very different political environment that I came from, into the more democratic, more mature democratic environment.
So you did your first degree. So you studied in Venezuela.
No.
So you were in Venezuela when you were applying, but then you actually studied. Yes. I understand that in Germany. Yeah. But my goodness. So did you find that when you were with your fellow students, were you, what was their apprehension of you, having had this incredibly, culturally diverse, background? I mean, did you kind of feel that when you were studying that you were able to see things through a very different sort of lens, and were people sort of quite, sort of looking up to you as a sort of, wow, you've got this amazing sort of experience and sort of, cultural sort of underpinning, something that I certainly did not have. I sort of, went to university. I did so much growing up at the age of 18. I sort of started living at university. Whereas you had all these wonderful antecedents. I just sort of wondered whether, there's almost, I suppose the word I'm looking for is the exotic. It seems as though you went to university and you were probably very mature in the sense that you had so much, you did so much living before you went to university, that actually the interplay between the academic and everything else going on in your life probably meant that you were, able to sort of think through things in a very different way to many of your peers.
I think, yes, definitely there's, obviously when you move around a lot and you live in different contexts, what you learn is to look at things through different lenses or from different viewpoints. In terms of the reaction of people that I met, that was very different. You could meet very skeptical people who find that just highly suspicious, and then on the other hand, obviously people who are more open-minded and find it interesting. And this is not an experience that I only had at university. I had my first experience with how people react to me coming from having lived somewhere else when I was 9 years old and I moved back to Germany from Namibia. My whole life had been in Namibia, so obviously anything that I told people that I met was, in Africa we did this and in Africa we did that. And I remember that one day one of my friends turned around to me and said, "Oh, can you just stop talking about Africa all the time?" And so I think that there was a time then where I thought, "Oh, so not everybody's interested in those in what I have to say," and obviously they couldn't sort of share the experience at the time, which I guess a consequence of that was that I didn't talk about it and I waited for people to ask me about it. And then I was very happy when my parents told me that we were going abroad again, because I thought, oh, I will meet other children who have similar experience, because obviously the children that I went to school with all were kids of diplomats or...
But it shows there's no correct paradigm, because I remember... Probably about 12 years ago, I was in Canterbury at the bus station, actually. And obviously, there are lots of French visitors in Canterbury in terms of our location. And they were walking by and they were talking in French. And there was a man sitting and he was reading The Sun newspaper. And he looked up and he told them off. And he said, "We're in England. We speak English over here." And they looked at each other and just thought, "I can't believe what he said." He was reading The Sun as well, which kind of sort of thought, well, you know, it, yeah. And I think they just looked, and they were so shocked by this. They just continued to speak in French, but even more loudly. But I mean, it just shows that sometimes you see. As I mentioned the word exotic, because you know what you were saying, you know, sounded so fascinating. But I think some people are also very comfortable or prefer to stick within their comfort zones. I think for that reason, there's often a fear of the unknown, or the sense that you've lived a life which either they haven't been able to or don't want to, and it's such an alien experience that it just sort of is not something that they can relate to. Mm. But have you had that in any other sort of contexts as well?
I mean, yes, I think there's people react either they are curious about it or scared. Or sometimes maybe even envious. So then you get all sorts of reactions to that. My parents, when they moved back to Germany after they had been in Venezuela for 8 years, they found it very hard at the beginning to meet people who weren't sort of scared away by the fact that they had been moving around a lot. And I think, I don't know, it's funny, as if people feel inadequate because they haven't. That's what they heard a lot from just sort of the generation of my parents, that they were saying, well, you've had this exotic life, and why are you interested in talking to me, because I can't share that I've been living in this village all my life. But that's not the point. You can have just as an interesting life living in one spot. It doesn't say anything about how interesting your life is. But obviously the when you talk about things, you refer to what you know. And I know things from different cultures and different countries, so sometimes I might be referring to concepts that are alien to people who haven't lived in those countries.
Yeah, but exactly. And I think that you know, there's no one size, shall we say, that fits all. But a few more philosophically oriented questions. Would you say that your memories are predominantly positive? You know, when you look back over your whole life, and when you sort of look, having had such a rich set of experiences growing up in different countries, do you look back and, you know, I mean, we used the word, I think, bittersweet earlier, or if not bittersweet, certainly homesickness. And, you know, do you sort of look back and do you have any regrets, perhaps, also about, you know, ambitions that maybe you had and maybe still have that haven't been realised?
I'm looking... So my memories are predominantly positive. But I think because I have spent very positive years and very happy years in those different places, of course there is some sort of sadness or melancholy if you look back and you think about the points where you had to leave those lives behind, and even though then something new and positive came after that, there's obviously always that kind of little feeling of sadness.
Does it relate to particular periods? Do you sort of like early childhood or adolescence or university, or is it
generally, I think when something stops, it's always sad. But I've also learned that it always means that something new is coming, and there's new things happening, and that you sort of almost have a crying and a laughing eye.
And sometimes at the same time.
Yes. I mean,
and actually, sometimes literally, because the number of times sometimes when I'll well up and I'll feel teary eyed, and I think, no, I'm fine, I'm happy. You know, these are tears of happiness, but obviously the need to be defensive. You know, the defensiveness is also interesting in my part. But you know, and it's interesting sometimes that you can feel a sense of real warmth about something, but also that can make you sort of, it can really affect you, and you can feel very emotionally connected to a person, to a place, to an event. Maybe the irretrievability of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about the question? You know, have you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young, or you know, do you still entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life that may be in keeping with what you dreamed about doing as a child or at university?
Yes, I mean, the one thing that from the day I could read, I read books, and from the day I read books, I wanted to become a writer, and that hasn't changed. So, and I'm still, I'm doing creative writing in my free time and so on, but I think the one thing that I'd really like to do would be to really write a book and publish it. I think that's the one ambition that I'm really.
And would it be a work of fiction? You mentioned creative writing.
Yes.
Yeah. And do you think you would draw on your autobiographical experiences, or would you do something completely, outside of that comfort zone?
I don't know. I really don't know. I did attend a creative writing course some time ago, and the teacher said, set a homework, and it was to write about what you know best, so the area or the city or the town or the place you know best. And I couldn't decide, and I really couldn't decide which place to choose. And in the end, I just wrote about the feeling of not knowing which place to choose, because I think that's probably what I know best.
Yeah, well, in a minute I'll ask you a binary question, but it's been answered differently by different people for that very reason. But before I get on to that one, I was just going to ask about whether you're in touch with friends from your past, especially when you would have had so many presumably different sets of friends growing up, and now in an age of social media, I don't know if you have any presence online, but do you keep in touch with those friends from the multiplicity of backgrounds that you grew up with?
I do, yes. So my oldest friend that I'm in touch with is in Namibia. She lived over here for a few years as well, because she actually married an English man and then took him back to Namibia. So we have kept in touch throughout, obviously throughout the late 80s and 90s, we wrote letters that then had to survive. Once we moved to Venezuela, had to survive two unreliable postal systems, so a lot of them got lost on the way, but we still managed to keep that contact going. And then obviously since there has been email and social media, that has become a lot easier. And then we spent some time together here in the UK, which was also nice to come back together in a way after many years. We are still in touch, and also with my classmates from Caracas. We were a very small class, there was only 16 of us, so we stay in touch. We actually met last year in France, there was 10 of the 16 could make it from all over the world. So that was really nice to see people again after 20 years.
And what was your apprehension when you saw them? Did they all look very different, or did you feel that you were able to almost carry on with the conversations that you had from all those decades ago?
It was exactly that. We just spent a whole weekend together at the pool doing, barbecue and just as we would have done in school days. And it was fantastic. It's really, really good.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like when you do write your novel, it sounds as though you can... Maybe you should do a set of short, an anthology, and then you can have all of these different... Yes. You know, you don't have to pick one. You can pick all of them. But no, my last question was, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I think I really try to live in the here and now rather than in the past or in the future. Looking back to the past is nice, and as I said, I have positive memories about that. But I did mention that earlier, there was a time when I really wanted to go back. I wanted to go back to Namibia in particular. But you have to realize that what you want to go back to is your childhood in a way, and that isn't there anymore. That has gone. Maybe one element of nostalgia for me is also that that looking back to the past is almost a memory of a time when everything that has since happened was still a possibility. And that maybe what you want to go back to isn't really that time, but is the sort of this situation of where there's still a lot of open question about your future. But likewise, when you look into the future and you have this wide canvas that you can, you know, paint your plans on, and you can make plans, but they will always change, won't they? It will never sort of work out exactly like you've planned it. So I think I'm neither. I think I'm a here and now person, and I do really enjoy my life, and it happens now. It doesn't happen in the past or in the future, really. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, when you do write that book, I can't wait, because it sounds as though you've got such a wonderful and a compelling narrative to tell. Valeska, thank you very much.
Thank you.